Hello and welcome to the Witterings Fitness Podcast. I'm here with Rory, our manager, and today we are going to talk about the difference between the 80% of members at Witterings Fitness who succeed with their health and fitness and get positive results, and the difference between the 20% who fail. Is a strong word, but I would say have less results and don't have a positive experience when they come into their journey. So what springs to mind, Rory? What's the main thing you've picked up on, do you think, with all the testimonials and reviews and things like that that you've done?
So my first thought was it comes back to that mindset bullshit that we've talked about before. And we mean bullshit jokingly, by the way. We don't think it's bullshit, but we know that a lot of people do, so that's our kind of in-house joke. Mindset bullshit. Yeah, to my mind, you're either empowered or you're a victim. It's binary. There's no middle ground. You're one way or the other. And circumstances, wealth, health, injury, surgery, they're not defining factors for success and failure. For me, it's, are you empowered and are you taking action, or do you think life is happening to you and you feel like a victim? And that's the difference.
Boom, mic drop. That's it, and that's all for today's podcast. What do you think it makes any, do you think there's circumstances of anybody who comes into the program that makes any difference to how well they get on?
Yes, in that I think people with demanding jobs or lively, chaotic kind of family situations, perhaps, you know, on paper, they've got more to deal with. But then it comes back, doesn't it, again, to boundary setting. That kind of clear demarcation. Actually, I think the difference, another difference between whether somebody succeeds and fails is, do they connect how they feel in the gym with benefits outside of the gym?
What do you mean by that?
So some people are very good at realizing that actually it improves their work performance, or that they're sleeping better, or that they're in a better mood with their loved ones, or that they feel more kind or more compassionate to people, they're more relaxed. And some people are not very intuitive when it comes to connecting how they feel in a workout and immediately afterwards with benefits elsewhere in their life, and they lose sight of that. And so therefore, when they get busy and stressed, they drop the workouts because, in air quotes, they don't have time. And then they feel like they've got even less time and they're even more stressed because it's the workout that gives them that sense of like abundance of time, of energy. And
so it's kind of their why and how much value they actually see out of the process that they're getting.
Yeah, perceived value, isn't it? I suppose if you perceive exercise and your training and everything that goes with that to be valuable to you, if you see it as a privilege to be able to train as opposed to an inconvenience or just something you need to do because the doctor's told you to do it, or because your wife or husband keeps hassling you to do it, then of course you're likely to drop it and then you're likely not to succeed. Whereas if you see it as a privilege, it's almost like a religious experience to come and do this.
We get grateful for it.
Someone in the, I was doing the pub quiz last night, they said, I'm not sure about that WhitFit cult, and I've just called it a religious experience. So that's going to go down well. But yeah, I think if you see it as a privilege, then you stay the course, you recognise the benefits, you end up being successful.
Yeah, so it kind of comes back to basically the attitude that they've got about it, and their sense of why. And I also think open-mindedness, you know, it makes a big difference.
Yep.
Are they open-minded? Are they gonna do they sort of read all the material that we give them? Do they make the effort to kind of log in and just watch a few videos. And I think some of the people who I've noticed who are the most successful people in terms of how much results they get, so it doesn't matter really about their starting position, but the value they get from it, they're the ones who like go back and watch the original videos, like from when they first started. And every time, I think it's like their awareness of, like, they know they're kind of going off track, and then they kind of go, right, I'm going back in and getting another dose of mindset bullshit.
Indeed, yeah. So like willingness to learn. So yeah, that willingness to learn piece is really important. And then as you were talking there, I was thinking, we're talking a lot about mindset. I mean, mindset is everything. Everything comes back to mindset. But thinking more about success and failure, maybe from a physical point of view, who breaks down and gets injured and doesn't stay the course, and who does, and who takes that kind of slow, steady approach? Those people who are
trusting the process,
more willing to give it time, don't use exercise to kind of thrash themselves or punish themselves, they tend to be more successful, don't they, in the long term? Because they don't break down, they attend regularly, they do their three or four sessions a week, they have fun.
It all comes back to the kind of merits principles, doesn't
it?
Yeah. Everything kind of comes back to that. If you move well, you then enjoy it, you remain humble.
Yeah. If you don't remain humble, or you push it too hard, you get injured.
Yeah.
You don't.
And if you don't move well, you get injured. You don't enjoy it. Vicious circle.
Absolutely. Indeed. And then on the, I suppose, the integrity side of things is going back, watching modules, thinking that you don't know everything.
Yeah, and being honest, like, I am off track.
Yeah.
My nutrition is shit. It needs work. And then putting their hand up to say, I do need help with that.
Yeah.
And I think those are the people, you know. What do you think, when you do the reviews, and what do you think the top things are that people say that they've done that makes them successful, or the top thing that they say, I just did that and that's what really helped? Is there a top thing, or is it?
What comes up more than anything else is that people who engage with the community, people who really appreciate the value of the coaching, their satisfaction levels and their success seems to be higher. And then on the recovery side of things, people who drastically reduce the amount of alcohol that they drink and increase the amount of water they drink then sleep so much better, recover so much better, are then approaching their workouts in a better mood,
and then more
in a better physical state, and also they don't feel they need to make up for the night before or whatever else and drive themselves into a hole through their training.
Yeah, so they sort of get encouraged by the progress they've made.
Yeah.
And then they make more progress and they're like, oh my god, this is actually working, it's really good. But it does all, whilst we kind of cut in there with alcohol, there was a stage before that, which was the attitude and the mindset, or whatever you want to call it. I know some people don't like the word mindset, but it is what it is, I think, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think the embracing what's different about Witterings Fitness in terms of working in that small group environment where you're not attempting to program yourself, you're not attempting to coach yourself, you're being supported and encouraged by your fellow members, you in turn are doing that for them. Those people that are embracing of the uniqueness of Witterings Fitness are the most successful.
Yeah. What do you think when people start, and maybe they say it in their reviews, like, what do you think they're most worried about at the start?
They're most worried about, especially as the demographic has shifted, and we have got a little bit older, and we have got a little bit more female in terms of our, you know, what does the average member look like? I've noticed that there's a great deal of concern about, it's really very sweet actually, they're very concerned about, will their lack of knowledge or ability or fitness interfere with other people's workouts? So in that group setting, will they hold them up or will they slow them down? Would they slow their partner down, or will they take too much time or attention from the coach and otherwise impact everybody else? Which is of course such a generous attitude to have, because they're more worried about other people than themselves. Yeah. But that tends to be the type of attitude
that.
At first.
Definitely, yeah. What about their sort of expectations of what they're going to achieve, and then versus what they actually manage to, on like for the 80%, you know?
Well, most people who join us now have failed multiple times in the past at diets, new gym memberships, classes, activities they've gone and done. They've not stayed the course, or they've got themselves injured, or they've got disappointed and downhearted. And so a lot of them come in with quite low expectations in the first place. And given their age, they have this kind of unique combination of low expectations, but also it's sort of now or never.
Mm.
I've got to an age where if I don't do something about it now, will I ever be able to do something about this? And there's obviously, so there's a big impetus to do something about it, but there's also this real fear that, well, nothing before's worked, so why is this going to be any different?
Mm. And when it does, it's the best job in the world.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. Cool. What do you think the main, well, you've sort of covered it there, but what do you think the main failures or barriers to people starting are? What are they most worried about? You said about holding others up, but do you think there's anything else?
I think, and I haven't had this from, this isn't from the horse's mouth, this is me, my interpretation, but I think a lot of people are afraid to take the very first step because there's the potential for failure. And if you don't, of course you're just failing slowly if you don't do anything about it, but if you actually do something about it, you might expose yourself to something that you can't do or that you're incapable of, and it's going to confront all of those fears that you hold, that actually there is nothing you can do about this and you are stuck the way you are and that you'll always be this way. I think that's the very first thing. And then more practically, it's like, well, what's this environment going to be like?
Yeah.
How competitive is it going to be? How is the coach going to talk to me?
Am I going to get screamed and shouted at?
What's the expectation of my fellow members?
Yeah.
And
why do you think that guy in the pub sort of sees it as a cult, do you think?
Well, I was sat, we were a team of six, and there's obviously myself as a coach and former member, and then I had three other current members around the table and one ex-member who would like to return. So he had a table of Whitfitters basically there, and I think he was just poking fun at all of us because we're sat waiting for the quiz to start, and the quizmaster's also a member, and so we're just talking about fitness events and training around the table, and I think it was his way of sort of going,
being a bit
defensive. Lads, this is all you talk about, but also at the same time maybe secretly jealous.
Yeah. I think a lot of the time, because when people started saying that to me about, oh, it's a bit of a cult, wasn't it? I was like, well, what is actually a cult? And I sort of look it up and I'm like, so it's like a group of people who won't accept a sort of input from outside, which first of all, we're definitely not that. But then I thought immediately, football is probably the biggest cult sort of based thing out there, isn't it? So it's sort of like, well, football's much more of a cult than just a community in a gym.
We did reflect last night that we were safe and comfortable with the fact it wasn't a cult, but we'd get worried when you started using membership proceeds to get yourself a private jet, and when you developed a harem of all the members' wives, then we reckoned it'd be a cult.
Yeah, no one else is allowed to join. There's some sort of weird initiation process. Cool. Cool. Okay, let's switch it then. I know it's kind of probably a bit obvious, but what's the main reasons people fail or don't get the most out of the program when they join? Things to watch out for.
Failure to prioritize and prepare. So it comes back to, you know, what we talked about earlier. Boundary setting at work and at home. How efficiently can you manage your time? Kind of, you know, how much do you prioritize a workout? Do you prioritize a workout over taking a kind of an early morning or a late night work meeting that you probably shouldn't really be taking anyway for your own kind of well-being and mental health? Do you prioritize it over, I don't mean you give up every night out with your friends, but if you want to be out boozing two or three nights a week, then your priorities probably aren't in the right place to succeed with your whatever you want to achieve with your you know, health and well-being and fitness. So that, boundaries, time setting, prioritization, preparation in terms of, you know, literally giving yourself enough time to get up and get changed and get to the gym, but also preparation in terms of food, preparation in terms of booking your classes a week, 10 days in advance, so you can schedule around them, all of that good stuff. I think people who don't engage and make friends are probably less likely to succeed, because, you know, once you are part of a community, there's social value attached to coming and training, and people notice it when you're not there and they miss you and they encourage you to come back in. And we can't help as human beings but notice other people's success. So you're not going to notice that if you're not talking to them and asking them how they're doing, and you're almost getting that social proof from everyone you're around when you're training. If you engage and you really kind of join in. And then, as we've said, you know, be coachable, be open-minded, whether you're watching a module on nutrition and mindset at home, or you're listening to the coach in the class,
or coming to the accountability calls.
Yeah,
that's made a big difference to the people who attend.
I think people who grasp the fact that it's not about knowledge, it's about application. Very few, some members don't know some things,
yeah,
and they acquire the knowledge.
Yeah.
But most people don't have a knowledge problem, they've got an application problem. Okay. So when you tell them about an accountability call, they think, well, I know what healthy eating is. That's not the point. We don't doubt that you know. Are you actually doing it? Are you aware of what you're doing and not doing? And if, would you like to shine a light on that? And if you do, what do you find out? And are you humble enough to put your hand up and say, actually, I know I shouldn't be doing this,
yeah,
but I am. Can you help me, please?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It comes back to that kind of integrity as well. And I think awareness, just an awareness of what's going on. Some people maybe have those self-sabotaging behaviors and they just do them without thinking, and then don't, because the mind is so clouded and busy, they don't even know that they were doing those things.
Yeah.
You come across that?
Yeah. Yeah, quite often. But there is a part of that, I think, is willful ignorance as well.
Just not wanting to.
Yeah, I don't really even want to...
Confront it,
yeah. I'm sort of on an unconscious level, I'm aware of what I'm doing. But if I bring any sort of consciousness to this, I actually have to deal with it. And I don't want to deal with it yet.
Yeah. So this might be a bit of a controversial one, but how often do you think people blame mental health and use it as a kind of an excuse to just be like, oh, that's the way I am, rather than addressing it? And how much do you think like people could actually, by addressing it, move those mental health issues out of the way? Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes sense. I know what you're getting at. I think
I'm just depressed. Like, you hear it. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I'm just depressed. So, but are you? Are you actually diagnosed with depression? Or are you just depressed?
Yeah, but even if you are diagnosed with depression, yeah, the thing with saying, I am depressed, inherently, you're saying you as an individual are depressed, you always have been, you always will be. It's who you are.
This becomes a part of your identity.
Exactly. Whereas saying I currently have depression or I feel depressed just makes it, puts that space, doesn't it, between your intrinsic core and your identity and something you're experiencing now momentarily. It could be months, it could be minutes, but you know, it's something that you could move beyond.
Yeah, it doesn't become part of your who you are. And And the language is important, isn't it?
Yeah. It comes back to the kind of, are you empowered or are you disempowered? And let's be honest, it's quite convenient to label yourself if you feel like a victim, if you're disempowered and you don't really want to have to do anything about it.
Yeah. It's a tricky one, isn't it?
Mm.
Because with mental health is such a big topic at the moment, but I do feel like a lot of people aren't truly depressed. They may feel depressed, and even those, like you said, even if you are diagnosed with depression or anxiety or whatever, it doesn't have to be like that all the time. It doesn't have to be who you are.
No, I mean, it's inherently, it's part of the human experience to feel, to have a depressed mood on occasion or to feel anxious. But what we've done is we've created labels and structures through which to diagnose these things and medications to treat them. And we're diagnosing and medicating the human condition, basically. It's normal to feel anxious.
Yeah.
It's normal to feel to be depressed. It's traumatic. The human experience is basically a lesson in trauma. And how you deal with it, isn't it? So there's,
yay.
But it is. But there. But that's why. See, personally, to me, I know that sounds dark, but that I don't think that's depressing. I think it's enlightening because actually, the times where things are light and bright and fun are unfortunately in the minority. But that's a cause for celebration. To be able to find those moments and hold on to them is special.
And you wouldn't know what they were if you weren't depressed occasionally.
No.
So finding that...
It's also, you know, it's also a period in your day or in your week where your mood is slightly depressed is an early warning system, isn't it? Things are out of kilter. Your body's always looking for homeostasis, even in its kind of mental state. So if you're depressed for part of a day or a couple of days, start to assess why.
Yeah.
You know, diagnose depression.
It's like a light coming on your car's dashboard.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and if you ignore the fact that your oil is low, your car eventually will break down. If you ignore the fact your mood is depressed this week, eventually you will end up with a diagnosable
condition. How do you feel? So that's my next question, is how do you feel about diagnosis of mental health conditions?
Personally, I think that we have ended up diagnosing natural human states of mind, that we have ended up creating labels and diagnosis based on not much more than the knee. Do we go there in terms of, you know, Big Pharma and the convenience of having a condition that can be diagnosed? Like if and to sell and supply a drug to fix, but
I think maybe it comes back to that spectrum, doesn't it?
Yeah, even before that, if you think, you know, early 20th century pioneers like Freud and Jung and everyone who followed in their wake, especially the kind of American schools post-war, they, as society became increasingly complex, as human beings experienced greater levels of stress, and traditional social structures like a job for life, or the membership of your church, or the nuclear family, or your marriage, as those things broke down, it became increasingly difficult to like treat people psychiatrically. And so they had to look for an easier way of doing things than get somebody on the couch and give them an hour of talking therapy. And so we sought a kind of a medical solution to a human problem. And then we had to define who should receive these drugs. And so then you needed a diagnosis and a bracket.
Yeah.
And then a subdiagnosis, and then a subdiagnosis of that, and a subdiagnosis of that.
It sort of comes back to the spectrum we talked about before, where you were in that space where you were ill and the doctor got you back to not ill but not well. And it's just, they don't have time. It's not they don't want to or they don't have the passion to do it. It's just they don't have time. So it's much easier just to, so many people, there's a pill.
Yeah.
Sort you out. And the best thing is obviously get you moved all the way up that spectrum to optimal well-being, but that takes time and investment.
Yes. And I don't have the details to hand, so I probably shouldn't pass comment on this publicly, but there was a groundbreaking meta-analysis of all of the studies on the efficacy of SSRIs released a month or two ago.
What's SSRIs?
Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, so like antidepressants.
Yeah.
Your classic antidepressant. And it shows no discernible benefit beyond baseline.
Amazing. Right, we've got to wrap it up there because we've got a session to take, but I feel like there's some other ways we could take that conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, thanks for listening. Cheers.
Please,
Rory.
Don't shout at us.